Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the Smithsonian Magazine, the January-February edition, which, by the way, is highlighting stories from the year 1968. Today, the first article is written by Valerie Landau, titled, The Man Who Invented the Future. 2 decades before the personal computer, a shy engineer unveiled the tools that would drive the tech revolution. A close colleague looks back on his vision. On December 8, 1968, Douglas Engelbart sat in front of a crowd of 1,000 in San Francisco, ready to introduce networked computing to the world. Engelbart was no Steve Jobs. He was a shy engineer with no marketing background. His goal was to speak directly to other engineers, showing them that they could use computers in new ways to solve complex human problems. That message was radical enough in 1968. Most programmers of the day used punched cards to carry out quantitative tasks like tabulating census data, writing banking code, or calculating a missile's trajectory. Even in the futuristic 2001 A Space Odyssey, which came out in April 1968, the HAL 9000 was an enhanced version of the same thing. It could play chess and make small talk with the crew members and ultimately sabotage the whole mission, but its job was still to compute numbers and run systems. HAL didn't give its users ways to write, design, or collaborate on documents. Engelbart didn't just come up with the notion of using computers to solve the urgent and multifaceted problems facing humanity. He also gave the first ever live demonstration of networked personal computing. Today, it's known as the mother of all demos, a precursor to every technology presentation that's happened since, and arguably more ambitious than any of them. When Engelbart walked on stage, he was wearing a headset with a microphone so he could talk to other members of his team at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park. Engelbart's team ran 30 miles of cables over the highways. In order to project the demo, on a 22 by 18 foot screen, they borrowed a projector from NASA. Engelbart started with a provocative question. If in your office, you, as an intellectual worker, were supplied with a computer display backed up by a computer that was alive for you all day and was instantly responsive to every action you have, how much value could you derive from that? Then he began to type, using a keyboard with numbers and letters instead of inputting information from a punch card. Text appeared on the screen. Word, 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 word. If I make some mistakes, I can back up a little bit, he noted, proudly showing off his new delete function. He announced he was going to save the document. Oh, I need a name, he explained, and titled it Sample File. He showed that he could copy the text and paste it again and again. Next, Engelbart pulled up a shopping list onto the screen. Apples, bananas, soup, beans. He moved the items up and down the list with simple clicks, organizing produce with produce, canned goods with canned goods, dairy with dairy. But there's another thing I can do, he declared. He pulled up a map of his route home with stops along the way. Library. What am I supposed to do there? He asked. A click on the word library pulled up another list. Oh, I see. Overdue books. He went back to the map and clicked on the word drugstore. Another list popped up, showing items like aspirin and chapstick. It wasn't just the software that was revolutionary. Engelbart had also invented a new tracking device with the help of Bill English, an engineer on his team. As the small device rolled, a dot on the screen rolled along with it. I don't know why we call it a mouse, Engelbart remarked. Sometimes I apologize. It started that way and we never did change it. Engelbart called his program the Online System, or NLS. His larger goal, beyond any of the specific functions he'd introduced, was for people to collaborate. Toward the end of his presentation, he alluded to an experimental network that would allow different users to collaborate from as far away as Harvard and Stanford. He was describing the ARPANET, a program that was just starting to begin at the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, ARPA, under the U.S. Department of Defense. Engelbart expected his presentation to attract hundreds of engineers eager to join him in this new wave of computing. He had, after all, introduced word processing, document sharing, version control, and hyperlinks, and he'd integrated text, graphs, and video conferencing. He'd even foreshadowed the internet. He thought the audience members would line up afterwards to ask how they could join his network and help develop his ideas. Instead, they gave him a standing ovation and then filed out of the auditorium. I found out about Engelbart almost by accident in 1986 when I was working on a TV show about Silicon Valley for the PBS station in San Jose. I was looking for a B-roll footage in the Stanford Library when Henry Lowood, a librarian, mentioned a film reel he had from a computer demonstration in 1968. I was riveted. After our program aired, Engelbart asked us to produce a video about his ideas. We never did make the video, but as I sat down to talk to him, I realized that what he was describing could actually change the world. It certainly changed me. I went to graduate school at Harvard and studied educational technology, and we worked closely together until his death in 2013. Engelbart's entire career was based on an epiphany he had in the spring of 1951. He had just gotten engaged and was working at NACA, the precursor to NASA, in Mountain View, California. He'd come a long way from his Depression-era childhood in rural Oregon, where he'd spent his days roaming the woods and tinkering in the barn. He realized he had achieved both his major life goals, a good job and a good wife. He'd pondered what he should aim for next. Then it hit him. "I just went click," he told me later. "If in some way you could contribute significantly to the way humans could handle complexity and urgency, that would be universally helpful." He had a vision of people sitting in front of computer monitors, using words and symbols to develop their ideas and then collaborate. "If a computer could punch cards or print on paper," he said, "I just knew it could draw or write on a screen, so we could be interacting with the computer and actually doing interactive work." At that time, there were relatively few computers in the world. The University of California, Berkeley, was building one, so he went there for his PhD. He earned several patents in 1962 while working at the Stanford Research Institute. He published a paper titled "Augmenting the Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework." At its core was the idea that computers could augment human intelligence. He outlined innovative ways of manipulating and viewing information and then sharing it over the network so people could work together. When he demonstrated this revolutionary idea in 1968, why didn't he get the response he'd been hoping for? I got some insight into this when I interviewed some of the engineers who had attended his demo. They told me they had been awestruck, but that nothing he described had any relation to their jobs. He was asking them to take too big a leap from doing calculations on punch cards to creating a new information superhighway. In the mid-1970s, Engelbart's lab, which he called the Augmentation Research Center, used government funding to support the quickly growing ARPANET. In a highly unorthodox move, he hired young women who graduated from Stanford with degrees in fields like anthropology and sociology. Engelbart, who had three daughters himself, believed that women were ideally suited to building new cultures. He sent his new hires out to other institutions to build networked improvement communities. This got him in a lot of trouble. The ARPANET's funders couldn't see why real people needed to support users. They saw his hires as a sign of failure. His systems weren't easy enough to use on their own. What Engelbart failed to communicate was that these women weren't just teaching people which keys to press. He wanted them to bring together thinkers who could collectively change the way the networks collected and analyzed information. Before long, the government reduced his funding, foreshadowing the end of his Augmentation Research Center. Later in the 1970s, Engelbart lost his key engineers to Xerox, PARC Lab, a lavish and well-funded research center a few miles away. At the head was Alan Kay, 15 years Engelbart's junior, an upbeat, brilliant guy who knew how to inspire people. The laboratory chief was Engelbart's former funder from ARPA, Robert Taylor. for Engelbart, networks had always been an inextricable part of his vision. But under Kay's direction, the engineers created a personal computer geared toward individual productivity rather than collaboration. Their software included more user-friendly versions of a few of Engelbart's original ideas, including multiple windows, text with integrated graphics, and the mouse. A cruel joke at the time was that Engelbart's Augmentation Research Center had been a training program for PARC. In 1979, Xerox allowed Steve Jobs and other Apple executives to tour its labs twice, in exchange for the right to buy 100,000 shares of Apple stock. Once Jobs began working on these ideas, they became even more streamlined. Engelbart's mouse had three buttons, which he used in different combinations to perform a range of tasks. After licensing this invention from the Stanford Research Institute, Apple decided it would be simpler to give it just one button. Engelbart lamented that the mouse's capability had been dumbed down to make it easy to use. Ironically, the mouse was the one invention that earned Engelbart's widespread recognition, though it never earned him more than the initial lump sum of $10,000 from the Stanford Research Institute. He was bewildered that the simplest artifact from his grand vision had been the most widely embraced. After all, he'd foreshadowed just about everything Apple and Microsoft went on to create, at a time when Jobs and Bill Gates were just 13 years old. Alan Kay himself once remarked, "I don't know what Silicon Valley will do when it runs out of Doug's ideas." Doug Engelbart's refusal to compromise was one of the main reasons he had a hard time gathering momentum. He had often ended discussions by declaring, "You just don't get it." That catchphrase cost Engelbart dearly. His detractors snidely remarked that the great proponent of collaboration was, ironically, unable to collaborate. I myself was at the receiving end of Engelbart's insults on several occasions, but no matter how irritable he behaved as a colleague, I knew he had great love for me as a person, and I understood why he so often felt frustrated. As I saw it, his ideas were so ahead of their time that there was often no language to describe them. When I asked him in 2006 how much his vision had been achieved, Engelbart answered, "About 2.8%. Because his system was designed to present the same information from different angles, it was more than a rudimentary version of the software we use today. I believe it was better equipped than Apple's or Microsoft's programs to solving problems like peace, income inequality, sustainable development, and climate change. He had designed it for sophisticated knowledge workers, writers, designers, data analysts, economists. Even Google collaborative apps are less ideally suited to do serious work that integrates libraries of data, documents, graphics, text, and information maps. Engelbart's system came with a learning curve, but he believed the result was worth it. When people praised other software for being more intuitive, he asked them whether they'd rather ride a tricycle or a bicycle. Although he earned over 40 awards, including the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, the $500,000 MIT Prize, and several honorary doctorates, Engelbart often felt demoralized. He died in 2013 after suffering from kidney failure, but many of us are still impressed by his dream. As a professor, I've brought his ideas to the classroom and seen them change the way my students think. As one of them wrote in a letter to our university president, "Team members are thinking together and tapping into the collective IQ to augment individual performance, and the whole of our group is much greater than the sum of its parts. It is an exhilarating and rewarding experience." Even in this interconnected age, the world could use more of that. And the next article is titled, "Houston, We Have a Photo," written by Andrew Chalkin. Apollo 8 returned to Earth with one of the most famous images in history. It's arguably the most iconic photograph of the 20th century, the Earth rising above the moon's bleached and desolate horizon, a breathtaking jewel of color and life more than 230,000 miles away. In December 1968, Apollo 8 astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders returned from history's first voyage around the moon with this stunning image. In the following weeks, on newspaper front pages and magazine covers around the world, we suddenly saw ourselves as inhabitants of a lovely and seemingly tranquil planet afloat in an endless void of space. In today's visually bombarded world, it's hard to imagine the immediate global impact of that single image. The picture that came to be known as Earthrise offered a precious moment of transcendence after a year of violence and turmoil. The following year, it was made into a U.S. postage stamp, and it adorned the cover of the whole Earth catalog. Walter Cronkite used it as a backdrop on the CBS Evening News. Wilderness photographer Galen Rowell called it the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. And it's no accident that 16 months after we saw ourselves from the moon, the first Earth Day took place. But one question about the Earthrise photo has dogged historians for almost half a century. Who took it? I can't help but take that question personally. I discovered the answer 30 years ago when I was researching my book about the Apollo astronauts, A Man on the Moon. I found myself challenging NASA's official version of the event and landing in the middle of a dispute between the astronauts themselves. Even after my book was published, the controversy continued for another 2 decades, until a NASA computer wizard confirmed my conclusion beyond all doubt. With the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8 approaching, I can't think of a better time to share the whole story, which is told on these pages for the first time. On December 24, 1968, I was a 12-year-old space fanatic glued to the television as Borman, Lovell, and Anders sent back live TV pictures from lunar orbit. I had my own mission control in the den, with models of the spacecraft, maps of the moon, and articles about the flight from Time and Newsweek. I did everything I could to feel like I was part of this amazing science fiction dream coming true. Almost 2 decades later, I was sitting down with my childhood heroes, the men who went to the moon to hear their lunar experiences firsthand. In the summer of 1987, preparing for my interviews with the Apollo 8 crew, I pored over stacks of NASA documents, including the recently declassified official transcripts of the astronauts' private conversations captured by the onboard voice recorder. I could never have imagined what I saw on those pages, not only the cool professionalism I was expecting, but moments of awe, tension, gallows humor, and at one point, what sounded like an exasperated father ordering his kids to bed. These were the words of three men out on a very long limb. I was fascinated to see three distinct personalities emerge from these pages. Borman was the no-nonsense and sometimes gruff mission commander, whose overriding concern was making sure that when it came time for the life-or-death rocket firing to send them back to Earth, his crew would be rested and ready. Jim Lovell, the flight's navigator, struck me as a kind of everyman. As he sighted the lunar landmarks, he voiced amazement at the experience of being one of the first humans to see the moon's far side with his own eyes. And finally, there was Bill Anders, the flight's serious, detail-oriented rookie, focused on his extensive program of photographing lunar features. The onboard voice recorder wasn't always turned on, but as luck would have it, NASA's transcript included the moment when the astronauts first saw the Earth rise. Borman: "Oh my God, look at that picture over there! Here's the Earth coming up! Wow, isn't that pretty?" Anders: "Hey, don't take that. It's not scheduled." These lines seemed to clearly confirm the story Borman first told on the pages of Life magazine in early 1969. His rookie crewman, Anders, had been so concerned with sticking to his program of lunar photography, wrote Borman, that when I wanted to take the picture of the Earth as it came up over the horizon, he objected. "Gee, Frank," he said, "it's not on our photo plan." Eventually, I was able to talk him into giving me the camera so I could take pictures of the Earth over the lunar landscape. But when I interviewed Bill Anders during the summer and fall of 1987, I heard a different story. The far side of the moon turned out to be less dramatic than he expected. But when he described the Earthrise, Anders tapped into an awe that was undiminished by the passage of nearly 2 decades. "That was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen," said Anders. totally unanticipated. Because we were being trained to go to the moon, it wasn't going to the moon and looking back at Earth. I never even thought about that. Seeing the Earth rise, Anders told me, had changed his view of the mission in real time. In lunar orbit, it occurred to me that here we are, all the way up there at the moon, and we're studying this thing, and it's really the Earth as seen from the moon that's the most interesting aspect of this flight. The famous Earthrise photo, however, was the source of a lingering frustration for Anders. He was all but certain he had taken it, but Borman's story about grabbing the camera away from him was the accepted one. Borman was even named the photographer in National Geographic, and Jim Lovell had started saying he took the picture as a joke. It so irritated Anders that he wrote to NASA's astronaut photography expert, Dick Underwood, for confirmation. Underwood's reply, as Anders recalled, is, "I think you took it." After interviewing Anders, I wondered if the Earthrise dialogue in NASA's transcript had been attributed to the wrong astronaut. There was only one way to find out. And by the fall of 1987, I had obtained copies of the original onboard tapes from NASA. When I got to the tape of the Earthrise, I had absolutely no trouble recognizing the voices. I could clearly hear that it was Anders who first saw the Earth coming up, not Borman. It was Borman who said, "Don't take that, it's not scheduled." And I realized he was teasing Anders about his strict adherence to the photo plan, because as the tapes also revealed, when Borman wanted to take a tourist photo of a crater hours earlier, Anders told him not to. I listened as Anders urgently asked Lovell for a roll of color film. Then Lovell was in his own window and the two men argued about who had the better view. Lovell demanded Anders hand over the camera. Anders told Lovell to calm down. Finally, Anders snapped two color pictures. Hearing this historic moment unfold, I felt like a stowaway aboard Apollo 8. When I delved deeper into the photo archives from Apollo 8, one added wrinkle awaited me. The iconic color image wasn't the first Earthrise photo, as most people assumed. Just before he saw the Earth coming up, Anders had been photographing the moon with black and white film, zooming in on the craters below with a 250-milliliter telephoto lens. Seeing the Earth rise, he fired off a black and white picture before asking Lovell for the color film magazine. All three Earthrise pictures, the black and white and the two color, had been taken with the same 250-millimeter lens. In our interviews, Anders said Borman had disliked the 250-milliliter lens and had opposed including it on the mission, a detail that was consistent, he said, with his memory that he, not Borman, had taken the iconic photo. Now I was able to tell him that the tapes proved him right. I was proud of my discovery. I had been able to get inside one of the most compelling moments in space exploration and present it with new clarity, something a historian lives for. There was just one more person I had to tell, Frank Borman. As I prepared to interview Borman in March 1988, I didn't know what to expect. Would he turn out to be as gruff as he had sometimes seemed aboard Apollo 8? I was happily surprised to find Borman anything but difficult. He laughed easily, he answered my questions about Apollo 8 and about his crewmates with complete candor. Over dinner with his wife, Susan, Borman brought up the subject I had been avoiding. "Did Anders ever tell you how we got the picture that became the stamp?" "Why don't you tell it?" I replied. "That son of a bitch, he wasn't going to take the picture," Borman began, clearly relishing another chance to tell the story. "I'm looking over the lunar horizon, and there's the Earth coming up. And I'm saying, 'Bill, take that picture, get that one.' He says, 'I can't.' 'Why not?' 'I don't have enough film. All my film's allocated for scientific.' I said, 'Bill, you're full of baloney. That is the only picture that anybody will remember from this goddamn flight. None of your volcanoes and craters take that picture.' He said no. So I took the camera and took the goddamn picture. That's the truth of the story. And it's probably on the transcripts, too. Did you read it?" Well, the moment had arrived. I told Borman the tape showed that, for all these years, he'd misremembered the event, confusing it with his run-in with Anders over his tourist shot of a crater hours earlier. Also, I had found evidence that Borman had taken several Earthrise pictures later in the flight with a wider lens. "You have an apology to make," said Susan. But Borman insisted he wasn't going to change his story because it illustrated Andrew's rigid devotion to his photo plan. The conversation ended in laughter. I was relieved Borman was taking it so well. That October, I caught up with Borman again as he was promoting his newly released autobiography. He told me he tried to have the wording about the Earthrise picture changed before the book came out, but hadn't been able to. But a month later, when the Apollo 8 crew gathered in San Diego for their 20th reunion, Borman publicly admitted he had been wrong about who took the picture, that it had been Anders. The issue was settled, or so I thought. Over the next 20 years, the controversy resurfaced. I was irritated to see books come out with the old version of the story. I was even more aggravated to see Anders in interviews going along with that version. I began wondering if there might be a way to get definitive confirmation of my discovery. In 2012, I met the man who would do that. Ernie Wright, from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. In early 2012, using NASA's original data on Apollo 8's orbit, Wright was able to reconstruct the astronauts' path over the moon when they first saw the Earthrise, even pinpointing the locations where the three Earthrise pictures had been taken. When he showed it to the LRO scientist and Apollo geek Noah Petro, they decided to release the video in time for Earth Day. About a week after the video's release, Bill Anders came to Goddard at the invitation of LRO scientist Jim Rice. Wright had already heard that Anders was skeptical he could accurately recreate the Earthrise, but at his computer, Wright showed Anders how he could move a virtual camera along Apollo 8's orbit and see the Earth rising. The LRO data made Wright's recreation of the lunar terrain so accurate that you could superimpose the real Earthrise photo over the simulation and hardly see any difference. Anders turned to Wright and said, "Your picture's better than mine." After Anders' visit, Wright felt compelled to take his Earthrise reconstruction to the next level. "Now I was holding some tiny piece of Bill Anders' legacy in my hand," he recalls. He decided to do a full recreation, one that would show not only Apollo 8's flight path, but also which of the craft's five windows was turned toward the rising Earth, and as a consequence, who took the pictures. Even before I met Wright in May 2012, he had been coming around to my point of view. He had listened to a digitally cleaned-up copy of the onboard voice tapes, and he had actually heard the sounds of the Hasselblad camera snapping each of the three Earthrise pictures, at just the times that would have fit if Anders had been the photographer on all three images. "After listening to this," Wright wrote to Jim Rice, "I'm leaning toward the fact that Bill took all three photos." Meeting him, I also noted that less than a minute before the Earth appeared on the horizon, Frank Borman had been occupied with steering the spacecraft through a 180-degree spin. A year went by with little progress, but in May 2013, Wright emailed me, "I think I have new evidence that Bill Anders took all three Earthrise photos." On a website called the Apollo Flight Journal, created by historians David Woods and Frank O'Brien, he had found a set of pictures taken by another camera, operating on a timer during the first Earthrise. When Wright used his animation software to match Apollo 8's orientation to each photo, he realized something remarkable. The spacecraft was pointed nose down at the moon and was still rotating under Borman's command when the Earth appeared. At any given moment, only one side of the turning spacecraft was facing the Earth. But which side? Wright calculated camera angles and windows' field of view, then simulated the view through each window of the turning spacecraft as it moved in its orbit. Suddenly, he had the clincher. When it first came up, the Earth was visible only through Anders' side window, and you had to press your nose up almost against the glass to see it. By the fall of 2013, Wright and colleague Dan Gallagher had produced a new video, synchronized with the onboard voice tape. It reconstructed the historic moment in a way no one, except the astronauts, had previously experienced. But Wright got an email from an official at NASA headquarters saying, "Before you call Frank Borman a liar, which is exactly what you will be doing, I hope that you have ironclad evidence to prove your point." Wright responded with a full accounting of his findings and what they meant. "I don't think the astronauts lied," he wrote. "I think they were three overworked, sleep-deprived guys on a dangerous and entirely unprecedented journey. It shouldn't surprise anyone that they might misremember details about things that weren't vital to the mission." When the new video with my narration was posted in time for the 45th anniversary of the Earthrise in December 2013, I felt a sense of completion and admiration for the work that Wright had done. I've been glad to hear the astronauts like it too, but I must disclose that the joke is alive and well. A few months ago, when my wife emailed Borman a photo I had taken of last summer's total solar eclipse, Borman wrote back, "Great picture! But Anders just called and said he took it." That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.